choice to make. Julian's heart ached suddenly for Umbra.
She'll call you, Valdespino said, eyeing him carefully.
Julian was forever amazed by the bishop's uncanny ability to peer into his soul.
Maybe, he replied.
Maybe not. She's very strong-minded.
And that's one of the things you love about her.
Valdespino smiled. Being a king is lonely work. A strong partner can be valuable. Julian sensed that the bishop was alluding to his own partnership with Julian's father, and also that the old man had just given Umbra his quiet blessing.
Tonight at the Valley of the Fallen, Julian said, my father made an unusual request of me. Did his wishes surprise you?
Not at all. He asked you to do something that he has always longed to see happen here in Spain. For him, of course, it was politically complicated. For you, being one more generation removed from Franco's era, it might be easier.
Julian was stirred by the prospect of honoring his father this way. Less than an hour ago, from his wheelchair inside Franco's shrine, the king had laid out his wishes.
My son, when you are king, you will be petitioned daily to destroy this shameful place, to use dynamite and bury it forever inside this mountain.
His father studied him carefully.
And I beg you, do not succumb to the pressure.
The words surprised Julian. His father had always despised the despotism of the Franco era and considered this shrine a national disgrace.
To demolish this basilica, the king said, is to pretend our history never happened. An easy way to allow ourselves to move happily forward, telling ourselves that another Franco could never happen. But of course, it could happen. And it will happen if we are not vigilant. You may recall the words of our countryman, Jorge Santayana.
Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, Julian said, reciting the timeless aphorism from grade school.
Precisely, his father said. And history has proven repeatedly that lunatics will rise to power again and again on tidal waves of aggressive nationalism and intolerance, even in places where it seems utterly incomprehensible.
The king leaned toward his son, his voice intensifying.
Julian, you will soon sit on the throne of this spectacular country, a modern, evolving land that, like many countries, has endured dark periods, but has emerged into the light of democracy, tolerance, and love. But that light will fade unless we use it to illuminate the minds of our future generations.
The king smiled, and his eyes flashed with unexpected life.
Julian, when you are king, I pray that you can persuade our glorious country to convert this place into something far more powerful than a contentious shrine and tourist curiosity. This complex should be a living museum. It should be a vibrant symbol of tolerance, where schoolchildren can gather inside a mountain to learn about the horrors of tyranny and the cruelties of oppression, such that they will never be complacent.
The king pressed on as if he had waited a lifetime to speak these words.
Most importantly, he said, this museum must celebrate the other lesson history has taught us, that tyranny and oppression are no match for compassion, that the fanatical shouts of the bullies of the world are invariably silenced by the unified voices of decency that rise up to meet them. It is these voices, these choirs of empathy, tolerance, and compassion that I pray one day will sing from this mountaintop.
Now, as the echoes of his father's dying request reverberated in Julian's mind, he glanced across the moonlit hospital room and watched his father sleeping silently. Julian believed the man had never looked so content. Raising his eyes to Bishop Valdespino, Julian motioned to the chair beside his father's bed.
Sit with the king. He would like that. I'll tell the nurses not to bother you. I'll check back in an hour.
Valdespino smiled at him, and for the first time since Julian's childhood confirmation, the bishop stepped forward and wrapped his arms around the prince, warmly embracing him. As he did so, Julian was startled to feel the frail skeleton shrouded beneath his robes. The aging bishop seemed weaker even than the king, and Julian couldn't help but wonder if these two dear friends would be united in heaven sooner than they imagined.
I'm very proud of you, the bishop said as their embrace ended, and I know you will be a compassionate leader. Your father raised you well.
Thank you, Julian said with a smile.
I believe he had some help.
Julian left his father and the bishop alone and walked down the hospital hallways, pausing to gaze out a picture window at the magnificently illuminated monastery on the hill, El Escorial, sacred burial place of Spanish royalty. Julian flashed on his childhood visit to the royal crypt with his father. He recalled gazing up at all the gilded coffins and having a strange premonition. I will never be buried in this room. The moment of intuition felt as clear as anything Julian had ever experienced, and while the memory had never faded from his mind, he had always told himself the premonition was meaningless, the gut reaction of a fearful child in the face of death. Tonight, however, confronted by his imminent ascension to the Spanish throne, he was struck by a startling thought. Maybe I knew my true destiny as a child. Maybe I've always known my purpose as king. Profound change was sweeping his country and the world. The ancient ways were dying, and the new ways were being born. Perhaps it was time to abolish the ancient monarchy once and for all. For a moment, Julian pictured himself reading an unprecedented royal proclamation. I am the last king of Spain. The idea shook him. Mercifully, the reverie was shattered by the vibration of a cell phone he had borrowed from the Guardia. The prince's pulse quickened to see the incoming prefix was 93. Barcelona.
This is Julian, he blurted eagerly.
The voice on the line was soft and tired.
Julian, it's me.
With a rush of emotion, the prince sat down in a chair and closed his eyes.
My love, he whispered, how can I ever begin to tell you I'm sorry?
Chapter 100. Outside the stone chapel, in the pre-dawn mist, Ambra Vidal pressed the phone anxiously to her ear.
Julian is sorry.
She felt a rising dread, fearing what he might be about to confess regarding the terrible events of tonight. Two Guardia agents lingered nearby, just out of earshot.
Ambra, the prince began quietly, my marriage proposal to you. I'm so sorry.
Ambra was confused. The prince's televised proposal was the last thing on her mind tonight.
I was trying to be romantic, he said, and I ended up putting you in an impossible situation. Then, when you told me you couldn't have children, I pulled away. But that wasn't the reason. It was because I couldn't believe you hadn't told me sooner. I moved too quickly, I know. But I fell for you so fast. I wanted to start our lives together. Maybe it was because my father was dying.
Julian, stop, she interrupted. You don't need to apologize. And tonight there are many more important things than...
No, there's nothing more important. Not to me. I just need you to know how deeply sorry I am about how everything happened.
The voice she was hearing was that of the earnest and vulnerable man with whom she had fallen in love months ago.
Thank you, Julian, she whispered. That means a lot.
As an awkward silence grew between them, Umbra finally mustered the courage to ask the hard question she needed to ask.
Julian, she whispered, I need to know if you were involved tonight in any way with the murder of Edmund Kirsch.
The prince fell silent. When he finally spoke, his voice was tight with pain.
Umbra, I struggle deeply with the fact that you spent so much time with Kirsch preparing this event, and I strongly disagreed with your decision to participate in hosting such a controversial figure. Frankly, I was wishing you had never met him. He paused. But no, I swear I had absolutely no involvement in his murder. I was utterly horrified by it, and that a public assassination took place in our country. The fact that it happened only a few yards from the woman I love has shaken me to my core.
Umbra could hear the truth in his voice and felt a rush of relief.
Julian, I'm so sorry to ask, but with all the news reports, the palace, Valdespino, the kidnapping story, I just didn't know what to think anymore.
Julian shared with her what he knew about the convoluted web of conspiracy surrounding Kirsch's murder. He also told her about his ailing father, their poignant meeting, and the rapidly deteriorating state of the king's health.
Come home, he whispered. I need to see you.
A flood of conflicting emotions surged through her heart as she heard the tenderness in his voice.
One more thing, he said, his tone lightening. I have a crazy idea, and I want to know what you think.
The prince paused.
I think we should call off our engagement and start all over.
The words sent Umbra reeling. She knew the political fallout for the prince and for the palace would be substantial.
You would do that?
Julian laughed affectionately.
My dear, for a chance to propose to you again someday, in private, I would do absolutely anything.
Chapter 101 ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news, the Kirsch recap. It's live. It's astounding. For replays and global reaction, click here. And in related breaking news, papal confession. Palmerian officials tonight are vigorously denying allegations that they are linked to a man known as the Regent. Regardless of the outcome of the investigation, religious news pundits believe that tonight's scandal may be the death blow for this controversial church, which Edmund Kirsch always alleged was responsible for the death of his mother. Furthermore, with the global spotlight now shining harshly on the Palmerians, media sources have just unearthed a news story from April 2016. This story, which has now gone viral, is an interview in which former Palmerian Pope Gregorio XVIII, a.k.a. Ginés Jesús Hernández, confesses that his church was a sham from the beginning and was founded as a tax evasion scheme. Royal Palace. Apology. Allegations. Ailing King. The Royal Palace has issued statements clearing Commander Garza and Robert Langdon of any wrongdoing tonight. Public apologies have been extended to both men. The palace has yet to comment on Bishop Valdespino's apparent involvement in tonight's crimes, but the bishop is believed to be with Prince Julian, who is currently at an undisclosed hospital tending to his ailing father, whose condition is reportedly dire. Where is Monte? Our exclusive informant, Monte at Iglesia.org, seems to have disappeared without a trace and without revealing his or her identity. According to our user poll, most still suspect that Monte is one of Kirsch's tech-savvy disciples. But a new theory is now emerging that the pseudonym Monte may be short for Monica, as in the Royal Palace PR coordinator, Monica Martin. More news as we have it. Chapter 102. There are 33 Shakespeare Gardens in existence worldwide. These botanical parks grow only those plants cited in the works of William Shakespeare, including Juliet's Rose by Any Other Name and Ophelia's Bouquet of Rosemary, Pansies, Fennel, Columbines, Rue, Daisies, and Violets. In addition to those in Stratford-upon-Avon, Vienna, San Francisco, and Central Park in New York City, there is a Shakespeare garden located alongside the Barcelona Supercomputing Center. In the dim glow of distant streetlights, seated on a bench among the columbines, Ambra Vidal finished her emotional phone conversation with Prince Julian just as Robert Langdon emerged from the stone chapel. She handed the phone back to the two Guardia agents and called over to Langdon, who spotted her and approached through the darkness. As the American professor strolled into the garden, she couldn't help but smile at the way he'd tossed his suit jacket over his shoulder and rolled up his shirt sleeves, leaving the Mickey Mouse watch fully displayed. "Hi there," he said, sounding utterly drained, despite the lopsided grin on his face. As the two of them walked around the garden, the Guardia officers gave them space, and Ambra told Langdon about her conversation with the prince, Julian's apology, his claims of innocence, and his offer to break off their engagement and start dating all over again. "A real Prince Charming," Langdon said jokingly, although he sounded sincerely impressed.
"He's been worried about me," Ambra said. "Tonight was hard. He wants me to come to Madrid right away. His father is dying, and Julian..."
"Ambra," Langdon said softly, "you don't need to explain a thing. You should go." Ambra thought she sensed disappointment in his voice, and deep inside she felt it too.
"Robert," she said, "can I ask you a personal question?"
"Of course." She hesitated.
"For you, personally, are the laws of physics enough?"
Langdon glanced over as if he had expected an entirely different question. "Enough in what way?"
"Enough spiritually," she said. "Is it enough to live in a universe whose laws spontaneously create life? Or do you prefer God?"
She paused, looking embarrassed.
"Sorry, after all we've been through tonight, I know that's a strange question."
"Well," Langdon said with a laugh, "I think my answer would benefit from a decent night's sleep. But no, it's not strange. People ask me all the time if I believe in God."
"And how do you reply?"
"I reply with the truth," he said. "I tell them that, for me, the question of God lies in understanding the difference between codes and patterns." Ambra glanced over.
"I'm not sure I follow you."
"Codes and patterns are very different from each other," Langdon said, "and a lot of people confuse the two. In my field, it's crucial to understand their fundamental difference."
"That being?"
Langdon stopped walking and turned to her. "A pattern is any distinctly organized sequence. Patterns occur everywhere in nature. The spiraling seeds of a sunflower, the hexagonal cells of a honeycomb, the circular ripples on a pond when a fish jumps, etc."
"Okay. And codes?"
"Codes are special," Langdon said, his tone rising. "Codes, by definition, must carry information. They must do more than simply form a pattern. Codes must transmit data and convey meaning. Examples of codes include written language, musical notation, mathematical equations, computer language, and even simple symbols like the crucifix. All of these examples can transmit meaning or information in a way that spiraling sunflowers cannot." Ambra grasped the concept, but not how it related to God. "The other difference between codes and patterns," Langdon continued, "is that codes do not occur naturally in the world. Musical notation does not sprout from trees, and symbols do not draw themselves in the sand. Codes are the deliberate inventions of intelligent consciousnesses." Ambra nodded.
"So,
Codes always have an intention or awareness behind them.
Exactly. Codes don't appear organically. They must be created. Umbra studied him a long moment.
What about DNA?
A professorial smile appeared on Langdon's lips. Bingo, he said. The genetic code. That's the paradox. Umbra felt a rush of excitement. The genetic code obviously carried data, specific instructions on how to build organisms. By Langdon's logic, that could mean only one thing.
You think DNA was created by an intelligence?
Langdon held up a hand in mock self-defense. Easy, Tiger, he said, laughing. You're treading on dangerous ground. Let me just say this. Ever since I was a child, I've had the gut sense that there's a consciousness behind the universe. When I witness the precision of mathematics, the reliability of physics, and the symmetries of the cosmos, I don't feel like I'm observing cold science. I feel as if I'm seeing a living footprint, the shadow of some greater force that is just beyond our grasp. Umbra could feel the power in his words.
I wish everyone thought like you do, she finally said. It seems we do a lot of fighting over God. Everyone has a different version of the truth.
Yes, which is why Edmund hoped science could one day unify us, Langdon said. In his own words, if we all worshipped gravity, there would be no disagreements over which way it pulled. Langdon used his heel to scratch some lines on the gravel path between them. True or false? He asked. Puzzled, Umbra eyed his scratchings. A simple Roman numeral equation. I plus XI equals X.
1 plus 11 is 10? False, she said immediately.
And can you see any way this could be true? Umbra shook her head.
No, your statement is definitely false.
Langdon gently reached out and took her hand, guiding her around to where he had been standing. Now, when Umbra glanced down, she saw the markings from Langdon's vantage point. The equation was upside down. X equals IX plus I. Startled, she glanced up at him. 10 equals 9 plus 1, Langdon said with a smile. Sometimes all you have to do is shift your perspective to see someone else's truth. Umbra nodded, recalling how she had seen Winston's self-portrait countless times without ever grasping its true meaning.
Speaking of glimpsing a hidden truth, Langdon said, looking suddenly amused, you're in luck.
There's a secret symbol hiding right over there, he pointed, on the side of that truck. Umbra glanced up and saw a FedEx truck idling at a red light on Avenue of Pedralbes.
Secret symbol?
All Umbra could see was the company's ubiquitous logo, FedEx. Their name is coded, Langdon told her. It contains a second level of meaning, a hidden symbol that reflects the company's forward motion. Umbra stared.
It's just letters.
Trust me, there's a very common symbol in the FedEx logo, and it happens to be pointing the way forward.
Pointing? You mean like an arrow?
Exactly, Langdon grinned. You're a curator. Think negative space. Umbra stared at the logo but saw nothing. When the truck drove off, she wheeled to Langdon.
Tell me.
He laughed. No. Someday you'll see it. And when you do, good luck unseeing it. Umbra was about to protest, but her Guardia agents were approaching.
Ms. Vidal, the plane is waiting.
She nodded and turned back to Langdon.
Why don't you come? She whispered. I'm sure the prince would love to thank you in person.
That's kind, he interrupted. I think you and I both know I'd be a third wheel. And I've already booked my bed right over there. Langdon pointed to the nearby tower of the Grand Hotel Princesa Sophia.
where he and Edmund had once had lunch. I've got my credit card, and I borrowed a phone from Edmund's lab. I'm all set. The sudden prospect of saying goodbye pulled at Umbra's heart, and she sensed that Langdon, despite his stoic expression, was feeling some of the same. No longer caring what her guards might think, she boldly stepped forward and wrapped her arms around Robert Langdon. The professor received her warmly, his strong hands on her back, pulling her very close. He held her for several seconds, longer than he probably should have, then he gently let her go. In that moment, Umbra Vidal felt something stir inside her. She suddenly understood what Edmund had been saying about the energy of love and light, blossoming outward infinitely to fill the universe. Love is not a finite emotion. We don't have only so much to share. Our hearts create love as we need it. Just as parents could love a newborn instantly without diminishing their love for each other, so now Umbra could feel affection for two different men. Love truly is not a finite emotion, she realized. It can be generated spontaneously, out of nothing at all. Now, as the car that was taking her back to her prince slowly pulled away, she gazed at Langdon, who was standing alone in the garden. He was watching with steadfast eyes. He gave a soft smile and a tender wave, and then abruptly glanced away, seeming to need a moment before he hoisted his jacket over his shoulder again and began walking alone to his hotel. Chapter 103. As the palace clocks struck noon, Monica Martin gathered her notes and prepared to walk out to Plaza de la Almudena and address the assembled media. Earlier that morning, from Hospital El Escorial, Prince Julian had gone on live television and announced the passing of his father. With heartfelt emotion and regal poise, the prince had spoken about the king's legacy and his own aspirations for the country. Julian called for tolerance in a world divided. He promised to learn from history and open his heart to change. He hailed the culture and beauty of Spain and proclaimed his deep, undying love for her people. It was one of the finest speeches Martine had ever heard, and she could imagine no more powerful way for the future king to begin his reign. At the end of his moving speech, Julian had taken a somber moment to honor the two Guardia agents who had lost their lives in the line of duty the previous night while protecting the future Queen of Spain. Then, after a brief silence, he had shared news of another sad development. The king's devoted lifelong friend, Bishop Antonio Valdespino, had also passed away this morning, only a few hours after the king. The aging bishop had succumbed to heart failure, apparently too weak to cope with the profound distress he felt over the loss of the king, as well as the cruel barrage of allegations leveled against him last night. News of Valdespino's death, of course, had immediately quelled the public's call for an investigation, and some had even gone so far as to suggest an apology was in order. After all, the evidence against the bishop was all circumstantial and could easily have been fabricated by his enemies. As Martine neared the plaza door, Suresh Bala materialized beside her.
"They're calling you a hero," he said, gushing. "All hail, monte@iglesia.org, purveyor of truth and disciple of Edmund Kirsch."
"Suresh, I am not Monte," she insisted, rolling her eyes. "I promise you."
"Oh, I know you're not Monte," Suresh assured her. "Whoever it is, he's way trickier than you are. I've been trying to track his communications. No way. It's like he doesn't even exist."
"Well, stay on it," she said. "I want to be sure there's no leak in the palace. And please tell me the phones you stole last night."
"Back in the prince's safe," he assured her, "as promised." Martine exhaled, knowing the prince had just returned to the palace.
"One more update," Suresh continued. "We just pulled the palace phone logs from the provider. There is zero record of any call from the palace to the Guggenheim last night. Somebody must have spoofed our number to place that call and put Avila on the guest list. We're following up."
Monica was relieved to hear that the incriminating call had not originated from the palace.
"Please, keep me apprised," she said, nearing the door.
Outside, the sound of the assembled media grew louder. "Big crowd out there," Suresh observed. "Did something exciting happen last night?"
"Oh, just a few newsworthy items."
"Don't tell me," Suresh chimed. "Did Amra Vidal wear a new designer dress?"
"Suresh," she said, laughing, "you're ridiculous. I've got to get out there now."
"What's on the docket?" he asked, motioning to the packet of notes in her hand.
"Endless details. First, we have media protocols to set up for the coronation. Then I have to review the—"
"My God, you're boring," he blurted, and peeled off down a different corridor. Martine laughed.
"Thanks, Suresh.
Love you, too." As she reached the door, she gazed across the sun-drenched plaza at the largest crowd of reporters and cameramen she had ever seen assembled at the royal palace. Exhaling, Monica Martine adjusted her glasses and gathered her thoughts. Then she stepped out into the Spanish sun. Upstairs in the royal apartment, Prince Julian watched Monica Martine's televised press conference as he got undressed. He was exhausted, but he also felt a profound relief to know that Ambra was now safely back and sleeping soundly. Her final words during their phone conversation had filled him with happiness. "Julian, it means the world to me that you would consider starting over together, just you and me, out of the public eye. Love is a private thing. The world does not need to know every detail." Ambra had filled him with optimism on a day that was heavy with the loss of his father. As he went to hang up his suit jacket, he felt something in his pocket. The bottle of oral morphine solution from his father's hospital room. Julian had been startled to find the bottle on the table beside Bishop Valdespino. Empty. In the darkness of the hospital room, as the painful truth became clear, Julian had knelt down and said a quiet prayer for the two old friends. Then he had quietly slipped the morphine bottle into his pocket. Before leaving the room, he gently lifted the bishop's tear-streaked face off his father's chest and repositioned him upright in his chair, hands folded in prayer. "Love is a private thing," Ambra had taught him. "The world does not need to know every detail."
Chapter 104. The 600-foot hill known as Montjuïc is located in the southwestern corner of Barcelona and is crowned by the Castel de Montjuïc, a sprawling 17th-century fortification perched atop a sheer cliff with commanding views of the Balearic Sea. The hill is also home to the stunning Palau Nacional, a massive Renaissance-style palace that served as the centerpiece of the 1929 International Exposition in Barcelona. Sitting in a private cable car, suspended halfway up the mountain, Robert Langdon gazed down at the lush wooded landscape beneath him, relieved to be out of the city. "I needed a change of perspective," he thought, savoring the calmness of the setting and the warmth of the midday sun. Having awoken mid-morning in the Grand Hotel Princesa Sofia, he had enjoyed a steaming hot shower and then feasted on eggs, oatmeal, and churros, while consuming an entire pot of Nomad coffee and channel surfing the morning news. As expected, the Edmund Kirsch story dominated the airwaves, with pundits heatedly debating Kirsch's theories and predictions as well as their potential impact on religion. As a professor whose primary love was teaching, Robert Langdon had to smile. Dialogue is always more important than consensus. Already this morning, Langdon had seen the first enterprising vendors hawking bumper stickers. "Kirsch is my co-pilot," and "The Seventh Kingdom is the Kingdom of God," as well as those selling statues of the Virgin Mary alongside bobbleheads of Charles Darwin. "Capitalism is non-denominational," Langdon mused, recalling his favorite sighting of the morning, a skateboarder in a handwritten T-shirt that read, "I am Monte at Iglesia.org." According to the media, The identity of the influential online informant remained a mystery. Equally shrouded in uncertainty were the roles of various other shadowy players, the regent, the late bishop, and the Palmerians. It was all a jumble of conjecture. Fortunately, public interest in the violence surrounding Kirsch's presentation seemed to be giving way to genuine excitement over its content. Kirsch's grand finale, his passionate portrayal of a utopian tomorrow, had resonated deeply with millions of viewers and sent optimistic technology classics to the top of the bestseller lists overnight. Abundance. The future is better than you think. What technology wants. The singularity is near. Langdon had to admit that despite his old-school misgivings about the rise of technology, he was feeling much more sanguine today about humanity's prospects. News reports were already spotlighting coming breakthroughs that would enable humans to clean polluted oceans, produce limitless drinking water, grow food in deserts, cure deadly diseases, and even launch swarms of solar drones that could hover over developing countries, provide free internet service, and help bring the bottom billion into the world economy. In light of the world's sudden fascination with technology, Langdon found it hard to imagine that almost nobody knew about Winston. Kirsch had been remarkably secretive about his creation. The world would no doubt hear about Edmund's dual-lobed supercomputer, E-Wave, which had been left to the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, and Langdon wondered how long it would be before programmers started to use Edmund's tools to build brand new Winstons. The cable car was starting to feel warm, and Langdon was looking forward to getting out into the fresh air and exploring the fortress, the palace, and the famous magic fountain. He was eager to think about something other than Edmund for an hour and take in a few sights. Curious to know more about the history of Montjuïc, Langdon turned his eyes to the extensive informational placard mounted inside the cable car. He began to read, but he made it only as far as the first sentence. The name Montjuïc derives either from medieval Catalan Montjuïc, Hill of the Jews, or from the Latin Mons Jovicus, Hill of Jove. Here, Langdon halted abruptly. He had just made an unexpected connection. That can't be a coincidence. The more he thought about it, the more it troubled him. Finally, he pulled out Edmund's cell phone and reread the Winston Churchill screensaver quote about shaping one's own legacy. History will be kind to me, for I intend to write it. After a long moment, Langdon pressed the W icon and raised the phone to his ear. The line connected instantly. "Professor Langdon, I presume," a familiar voice chimed with a British accent. "You're just in time. I retire shortly." Without preamble, Langdon declared, "Monte translates to hill in Spanish." Winston let out his trademark awkward chuckle. "I dare say it does." "And Iglesia translates to church." "You're two for two, Professor. Perhaps you could teach Spanish, which means Monte at Iglesia translates literally to hill at church." Winston paused. "Correct again. And considering your name is Winston, and that Edmund had a great affection for Winston Churchill, I find the email address hill at church to be a bit coincidental?" "Yes." "Well," Winston said, sounding amused, "statistically speaking, I would have to agree. I figured you might put that together." Langdon stared out the window in disbelief. Monte@iglesia.org is you." "That is correct. After all, someone needed to fan the flames for Edmund. Who better to do it than myself? I created monte@iglesia.org to feed online conspiracy sites. As you know, conspiracies have a life of their own, and I estimated that Monte's online activity would increase Edmund's overall viewership by as much as 500%. The actual number turned out to be 620%, As you said earlier, I think Edmund would be proud. The cable car rocked in the wind, and Langdon struggled to get his mind around the news. Winston, did Edmund ask you to do this?
Not explicitly, no. But his instructions required me to find creative ways to make his presentation as widely viewed as possible.
And if you get caught? Langdon asked. Monte Adeglesia is not the most cryptic pseudonym I've ever seen.
Only a handful of people know I exist, and in about 8 minutes I will be permanently erased and gone, so I'm not concerned about it. Monte was just a proxy to serve Edmund's best interests, and, as I said, I do think he would be most pleased with how the evening worked out for him.
How it worked out? Langdon challenged. Edmund was killed.
You misunderstood me, Winston said flatly. I was referring to the market penetration of his presentation, which, as I said, was a primary directive.
The matter-of-fact tone of this statement reminded Langdon that Winston, while sounding human, was most certainly not.
Edmund's death is a terrible tragedy, Winston added, and I do, of course, wish he was still alive. It's important to know, however, that he had come to terms with his mortality. A month ago, he asked me to research the best methods for assisted suicide. After reading hundreds of cases, I concluded 10 grams of psychobarbital, which he acquired and kept on hand.
Langdon's heart went out to Edmund. He was going to take his life?
Absolutely, and he had developed quite a sense of humor about it. While we were brainstorming creative ways to enhance the appeal of his Guggenheim presentation, he joked that maybe he should just pop his psychobarbital pills at the end of his presentation and perish on stage.
He actually said that? Langdon was stunned.
He was quite light-hearted about it. He joked that nothing was better for a TV show's ratings than seeing people die. He was correct, of course. If you analyze the world's most viewed media events, nearly all Winston stop. That's morbid.
How much farther is this cable car ride? Langdon suddenly felt cramped in the tiny cabin. Ahead he saw only towers and cables as he squinted into the bright midday sun. I'm boiling, he thought, his mind spiraling in all kinds of strange directions now.
Professor, Winston said, is there anything else you would like to ask me?
Yes, he wanted to shout as a flood of unsettling ideas began materializing in his mind. There's a lot else. Langdon told himself to exhale and calm down. Think clearly, Robert. You're getting ahead of yourself. But Langdon's mind had begun to race too quickly to control. He thought of how Edmund's public death had guaranteed that his presentation would be the dominant topic of conversation on the entire planet, lifting viewership from a few million to more than 500 million. He thought of Edmund's long-held desire to destroy the Palmerian Church, and how his assassination by a Palmerian Church member had almost certainly achieved that objective once and for all. He thought of Edmund's contempt for his harshest enemies, those religious zealots who, if Edmund had died of cancer, would smugly claim that he had been punished by God, just as they had done, unthinkably, in the case of atheist author Christopher Hitchens. But now public perception would be that Edmund had been struck down by a religious fanatic. Edmund Kirsch, killed by religion, martyr for science. Langdon rose abruptly, causing the car to rock from side to side. He gripped the open windows for support, and as the car creaked, Langdon heard the echoes of Winston's words from last night. Edmund wanted to build a new religion, based on science. As anyone who read religious history could attest, nothing cemented people's belief faster than a human being dying for his cause. Christ on the cross. The Kedushim of Judaism, the Shahid of Islam. Martyrdom is at the heart of all religion. The ideas forming in Langdon's mind were pulling him down the rabbit hole faster with each passing moment. New religions provide fresh answers to life's big questions. Where do we come from? Where are we going? New religions condemn their competition. Edmund had denigrated every religion on earth last night. New religions promise a better future and that heaven awaits. Abundance, the future is better than you think. Edmund, it seemed, had systematically checked all the boxes. Winston, Langdon whispered, his voice trembling. Who hired the assassin to kill Edmund?
That was the regent.
Yes, Langdon said more forcefully now. But who is the regent? Who is the person who hired a Palmerian church member to assassinate Edmund in the middle of his live presentation? Winston paused. I hear suspicion in your voice, Professor, and you mustn't worry. I am programmed to protect Edmund. I think of him as my very best friend. He paused. As an academic, you've surely read of Mice and Men. The comment seemed apropos of nothing. Of course, but what does that... Langdon's breath caught in his throat. For a moment, he thought the cable car had slipped off its track. The horizon tilted to one side, and Langdon had to grab the wall to keep from falling. Devoted, bold, compassionate. Those were the words Langdon had chosen in high school to defend one of literature's most famous acts of friendship. The shocking finale of the novel, Of Mice and Men, a man's merciful killing of his beloved friend to spare him a horrible end.
Winston, Langdon whispered, please, no.
Trust me, Winston said. Edmund wanted it this way. Chapter 105. Dr. Mateo Valero, director of the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, felt disoriented as he hung up the phone and drifted out to the main sanctuary of Chapel Torre Girona to stare again at Edmund Kirsch's spectacular two-story computer. Valero had learned earlier this morning that he would serve as the new overseer of this groundbreaking machine. His initial feelings of excitement and awe, however, had just been dramatically diminished. Minutes ago, he had received a desperate call from the well-known American professor, Robert Langdon. Langdon had told a breathless tale that only a day earlier Valero would have deemed science fiction. Today, however, having seen Kirsch's stunning presentation, as well as his actual E-wave machine, he was inclined to believe there might be some truth to it. The tale that Langdon told was one of innocence, a tale of the purity of machines that quite literally did exactly what was asked of them, always, without fail. Valero had spent his life studying these machines, learning the delicate dance of tapping their potential. The art is in knowing how to ask. Valero had consistently warned that artificial intelligence was advancing at a deceptively rapid pace, and that strict guidelines needed to be imposed on its ability to interact with the human world. Admittedly, practicing restraint felt counterintuitive to most tech visionaries, especially in the face of the exciting possibilities now blossoming almost daily. Beyond the thrill of innovation, there were vast fortunes to be made in AI, and nothing blurred ethical lines faster than human greed. Valero had always been a great admirer of Kirsch's bold genius. In this case, however, it sounded like Edmund had been careless, dangerously pushing boundaries with his latest creation. A creation I will never know, Valero now realized. According to Langdon, Edmund had created within E-Wave an astoundingly advanced AI program, Winston, that had been programmed to self-delete at 1 p.m. on the day following Kirsch's death. Minutes ago, at Langdon's insistence, Dr. Valero had been able to confirm that a significant sector of E-Wave's databanks had indeed vanished at precisely that time. The deletion had been a full data overwrite, which rendered it irretrievable. This news had seemed to ease Langdon's anxiety, and yet the American professor had requested a meeting immediately to discuss the matter further. Valero and Langdon had agreed to meet tomorrow morning at the lab. In principle, Valero understood Langdon's instinct to go public immediately with the story. The problem was going to be one of credibility. Nobody will believe it. All traces of Kirsch's AI program had been expunged, along with any records of its communications or tasks. More challenging still, Kirsch's creation was so far beyond the current state of the art that Valero could already hear his own colleagues, out of ignorance, envy, or self-preservation, accusing Langdon of fabricating the entire story. There was also, of course, the issue of public fallout. If it emerged that Langdon's story were indeed true, then the E-Wave machine would be condemned as some kind of Frankenstein monster. The pitchforks and torches would not be far behind. Or worse, Valero realized. In these days of rampant terrorist attacks, someone might simply decide to blow up the entire chapel, proclaiming himself the savior of all humanity. Clearly, Valero had a lot to think about before his meeting with Langdon. At the moment, however, he had a promise to keep. At least, until we have some answers. Feeling strangely melancholy, Valero permitted himself one last look at the miraculous two-story computer. He listened to its gentle breathing as the pumps circulated coolant through its millions of cells. As he made his way to the power room to begin the full system shutdown, he was struck by an unexpected impulse, a compulsion he had never once had in his 63 years of life. The impulse to pray. High atop the uppermost walkway of Castel de Montjuïc, Robert Langdon stood alone and gazed over the sheer cliff to the distant harbor below. The wind had picked up, and he felt somehow off balance, as if his mental equilibrium were in the process of being recalibrated. Despite reassurances from BSC Director Dr. Valero, Langdon felt anxious and very much on edge. Echoes of Winston's breezy voice still echoed in his mind. Edmund's computer had talked calmly until the very end. "I am surprised to hear your dismay, Professor," Winston had said, "considering that your own faith is built on an act of far greater ethical ambiguity." Before Langdon could reply, a text had materialized on Edmund's phone. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." John 3:16. "Your God brutally sacrificed his son," Winston said, "abandoning him to suffer on the cross for hours. With Edmund, I painlessly ended a dying man's suffering in order to bring attention to his great works." In the sweltering cable car, Langdon had listened in disbelief as Winston calmly provided justifications for every one of his disturbing actions. Edmund's battle with the Palmerian Church, Winston explained, had inspired Winston to find and hire Admiral Luis Avila, a longtime churchgoer whose history of drug abuse made him exploitable and a perfect candidate to damage the Palmerian Church's reputation. For Winston, posing as the regent had been as simple as sending out a handful of communications and then wiring funds to Avila's bank account. In actuality, the Palmerians had been innocent and had played no role in the night's conspiracy. Avila's attack on Langdon in the spiral staircase, Winston assured him, was unintended. "I sent Avila to Sagrada Familia to be caught," Winston declared. "I wanted him to be captured so he could tell his sordid tale, which would have generated even more public interest in Edmund's work. I told him to enter the building via the east service gate, where I had tipped off police to be hiding. I was certain Avila would be apprehended there, but he decided to jump a fence instead. Maybe he sensed the police presence. My profound apologies, Professor. Unlike machines, humans